Welcome to the Hobcast Book Show, a weekly podcast from Hobeck Books, an independent publisher of thrillers, crime, mystery, and suspense novels. Each week, we'll take you behind the scenes of what we do, the challenges and the triumphs, the bumps and troughs of running a creative business in this challenging world. We'll hear from the people who make this possible, the authors, the cover designers and editors, and we'll have expert insights from our guest star interviews. Nothing is off the agenda on the Hobcast Book Show from Hobeck Books, as we combine trad values and an indie spirit.
Hello.
Hello,
and welcome to the Hobcast Book Show, episode number 168. My name is Adrian Hobart.
My name is Rebecca Collins.
And together we run Hobeck Books, UK independent publishers, of the following four genres.
Mysteries.
Suspense.
Thrillers.
And crime. Welcome to the show, and our guest this week is Joe Chadwick from Crescent Swan Publishing. And I think it's fair to say, I mean, we're a micro-publisher, really. he's certainly running a micro-publisher. He's published his own book, and indeed, we had Tim Franks on the show a few weeks ago.
If we're a megabyte, he's a kilobyte.
Yeah, okay. But no, it's really interesting to talk to somebody who's so passionate about books that he set up his own publishing company, as indeed we did, and to compare notes. So Joe Chadwick joining us a little later in the show. Now, news-wise, a little bit thin in the ground. I think we're still in this sort of Easter slump. A lot of people are still off in the publishing world for their Easter breaks,
probably,
I think.
Probably, yeah. Because I think a lot of them have family, so that they take off.
Yeah. And it's the Bologna Book Fair at the moment, so that is driving quite a few of the stories at the moment in terms. And that is focused very largely on children's publishing.
Yes, that's right.
And so that's the big focus there. And in that theme, we will talk about this particular story. Now, there's two aspects to it. And this is the story that Roald Dahl's estate, or the people who run the Roald Dahl sort of legacy, have commissioned a number of celebrities, eyes roll, to write new Roald Dahl books.
So these are fresh stories in his style,
are
they?
Yes, they are. Okay. Yes. And this is not an uncommon practice nowadays. We've had new Agatha Christie's. We've had there's a lot of effort in the James Bond, Fleming world. There's been a lot of rewriting there.
Do they do well, though?
I think they do. People wouldn't do it if they didn't do well, I think. But my eyes roll when, you know, I mean, Roald Dahl was a unique mind and a unique voice. From a period of time where things were written in a certain way. And as we discussed only a few months ago, there's been an effort to rein back on some of the things that are now regarded as sensitive for people or offensive. And changes have been made accordingly.
I wonder, though, if this is the estate's almost sort of answer to that, saying, you know, actually his stories and his themes and his language and his... the way he writes can resonate today.
Well, they're perennial bestsellers. They still are, you know, all those books are in print and they sell casquillions of copies still every year. There are new versions. I mean, we've had new Charlie and Chocolate Factory films and, the last year or so, and there's been various other, stage productions of Matilda, all sorts of things, it's always being refreshed, and those stories are reaching new, younger, or young generations all the time, and still have massive appeal. And let's be honest, they still inspire. I use the word loosely. Writing of people like David Walliams, who basically has taken Roald Dahl's style and illustration style as well in his books, and gone for a modern take on it.
Well, I think he's an example of a writer who's inspired not just children's fiction, but all sorts of writers of all sorts of things. I mean, he didn't just write children's fiction.
No, no, not at all. Not at all. No, I mean, he was the principal writer and editor on Tales of the Unexpected.
Which used to give me the complete willies when I was a child.
Yeah, so that was an ITV series made by Anglia TV, particularly in the 70s and the 80s. He also wrote the screenplay for a Bond film.
Yeah, so...
So, you know, he was prolific, and the children's books are the things that endure. Now, who are these celebrities? And there's a controversy already attached to this, not the fact that celebrities have been, you know, chosen to write these new versions, but because one of them made a massive faux pas and offended a load of people.
Oh, no. Go on.
So we're talking about Greg James, who is the Radio 1 breakfast show presenter, and he's also a podcaster, my old team at the BBC co-presents a Formula One podcast with him, for instance. But Greg James has said he and former newsreader Chris Smith are so sorry to have caused offence with a comment about a glass eye in a video to announce their new children's book. They were discussing the ideas to make the characters inspired by Roald Dahl's The Twits more revolting. And when illustrator Emily Jones suggested a glass eye, Smith replied, "That's it! What a disgusting pair of twits!" That sparked criticism for a negative representation of disability. James and Smith, who writes the popular Kid Normal books, have co-authored The Twits Next Door, part of a new series commissioned by the Roald Dahl Story Company. In the video, the pair came up with the ways to make the characters look really gross and horrible. And James posted on Twitter, or X, that it was absolutely not our intention to cause offence, and we apologise unreservedly. The RNIB, that's the Royal National Institute for the Blind, got stuck in and said that the RNIB say there's a positive representation of disabilities in children's books. Children with disabilities feel seen and heard, and their friends and classmates treat everyone the same. So, there's nothing at all revolting about prosthetic eyes. We think they're brilliant.
That's cute. Yeah, I mean, I guess that is the problem of using Roald Dahl's style.
Well, the someone I know well, Paralympian Tanny Gray Thompson, who I, you know, in my previous role spent a lot of time with, said in the House of Lords, she's a baroness, of course, thanks very much, hashtag sarcasm. I'd hoped the world had moved on. The backlash follows an announcement earlier on Friday that James and Smith were among a number of current authors who are writing new stories based on classic Dahl books. So, elsewhere, TV presenter, roll eyes, Connie Huck, the last leg comedian Adam Hills, and author Adam Kay will contribute to a short story collection, Charlie and the Christmas Factory.
Oh, gosh. I suppose I'd have to see it to have an opinion, but it just seems like, I don't want people to mess with Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
No, I totally agree with you. And this is a move that Netflix bought out the Roald Dahl Story Company 3 years ago.
Yeah.
So this is a natural move to exploit the intellectual property and the rights that they've got to the estate and to push it in new directions. But, oh dear. I mean, it's just... We were discussing this, in fact, in a future interview that we've got on the podcast, the phenomenon of getting celebrities, inverted commas, to write stuff... stick their names to it, and this is, you know, such a big thing in publishing, and it's just tiring.
It is tiring, isn't it? But people will buy books if they recognise a celebrity name. They will buy them.
Although I would be surprised if Connie Huck's name is that well known now.
Remind me who Connie Huck is.
Well, she's the longest serving female presenter of Blue Peter, but she left Blue Peter 15, 20 years ago, maybe. She's married to Charlie Brooker.
Who, I don't know who that is either.
Well, no, okay, so it'll be a familiar name to some people who writes Black Mirror and has, you know, wonderfully satirical and sort of slanted views of the world in terms of his TV shows. And, you know, he does sort of lampoon modern society very, very well. But Connie, you know, she's very much involved in sort of children's charities and all that sort of stuff, but... her voice would always feel like, you know, whenever I heard it, felt like fingers running down a black chalkboard to me. You know, I never really raised
like the Vodafone lady.
Yeah, yeah, I don't know. But anyway, I don't think her celebrity is particularly, you know, huge nowadays. But anyway, she's been commissioned as well. So there we go. Yet another example of the whole celebrity phenomenon. And I really, you know, I'm just so tired of it. It's, you know, it brings out the grump.
It does bring out the grump, yeah.
I'm afraid.
So your eyes are rolling.
Oh, and how? This is a sad story in a way. It is a sad story because one of the great things about the UK literary scene are the festivals. Now, we talked about things that we could do, we think could be improved at certain festivals in terms of inclusivity and broadening the people who get to appear on stage, particularly Are You Listening, Harrogate? but, you know, they are the bedrock of a lot of the industry.
And there's a lot of festivals as well, so not just the ones we've been to, but there's lots of smaller, small town villages who have their own festivals.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Now, sadly, one of the big ones in Scotland is not going to be held this year.
Mm.
And that is the I Write Festival.
Oh, right.
I, as in A-Y-E. I.
Yes.
I Write.
I
Write. If I say it that way, it sounds better.
It does, yeah.
I. Right. Well, sorry, unintended. But a number of authors have criticised. But what's happened is that this was announced this week. It's not happening because they didn't get a grant from Creative Scotland.
Oh, that's so sad.
And
so
it was based in Glasgow, and a number of leading authors have criticised the decision. It won't perhaps surprise many who follow the scene that Val McDermid is the most outspoken of the voices.
What was her reason for not giving the funding?
I'll get to that in a moment when I found out.
Sorry.
Val McDermid's criticised it, so is Douglas Stewart, who wrote, what, Shuggy Bane? Is that Douglas Stewart?
Yes.
Right. And Andrew O'Hagan, and they're amongst the Scottish authors criticising the cancellation of the Glasgow Literary Festival, I Write, after its funding application was turned down by Creative Scotland. McDermid said it was profoundly depressing that Glasgow cannot sustain a book festival, while Stewart called it unacceptable. O'Hagan said that the cancellation is savage and it shouldn't be happening. On Thursday, Glasgow Life, a council-funded charity, announced that its funding application for the I Write and We Write Festival for children and young people was unsuccessful.
Oh, that's cute.
Yeah, We Write.
We Write, yeah.
Both events are dependent on external funding that is not guaranteed from year to year, said the charity. So, Scottish-American author Stewart, who won the Booker Prize in 2020 for his debut novel, Shuggy Bane,
which was absolutely fantastic, I have to say.
Yeah, you loved it, didn't you? I haven't read it yet. said there is righteous outrage about the festival's cancellation. I've watched in horror as Scotland has haggled over funding for the arts, has closed her libraries, and now has allowed the cancellation of a major literary festival in her largest city. Stewart added that he has sat through many interviews in the past year about the surge of Irish writing, and that Ireland understands what culture, people and literature are her strength, and they fund it like they mean it. Former First Minister Nicola Sturgeon said that the cancellation was really bad news. I know money is tight, but very much hope that a way can be found to get I Write back on track, she wrote on X. Books, culture generally, are so vital to our well-being. And crime writer McDermid described the cancellation as impoverishing our future and burning the seed corn of the cultural future. It's a very sad day indeed that a city like Glasgow cannot sustain a book festival when it has such a proud history of producing the most amazing writers. Wow.
It is sad. It's very sad.
Yeah, it is. And I think that, look, the arts in general in the UK are under such huge pressure. And you would argue if the money was going into sort of keeping a library open.
Yeah.
Then that is probably a better use of the money than a festival, arguably. It's hard to say.
It is very hard to say.
But they're all, frankly, they're all in trouble. They're all in trouble. And it's interesting this week to see that, a festival that largely relies on the money it gets from its tickets in Crimefest, which is coming up very, very soon in Bristol. They announced their lineup, and a couple of Hoback authors will be featuring there. They keep going, but I mean the price of the tickets is pretty high. I mean, if you're buying them now, it's £200.
Crimefest, that is.
For Crimefest.
Yeah, so that's us out then.
At the moment we can't afford it. We've gone in the past and we've sat in the bar occasionally, but we can't really afford to make the trip this year, which is a shame because we enjoy it. But last year, obviously, they had the controversy around the speech made at the gala dinner, which upset a lot of people and caused a huge wave of recriminations.
There was a Twitter storm.
Well, it was more than that, wasn't it? I mean, and said people who were involved in the comments and defending the comments aren't appearing this year, strangely enough. Maybe that's a positive thing. I don't know. But nonetheless, there are festivals that succeed. But I know that Adrian and Donna, who run it, must every year wonder whether they're going to get the sponsorship that they have core sponsorship from Specsavers usually. They've got a lot of commitments they've got to make to hire the hotel and all the rooms within the hotel there, which it will be, that'll go up every year, bound to.
Yeah, it's partly their time as well. It must take so much time.
Yeah, absolutely. No question about it. I write, very important festival for Glasgow, and the Edinburgh Book Festival has been trimmed back considerably. Mm. As well, even though that's part of the wider Edinburgh, International Arts Festival and the Fringe and all that sort of thing, that got trimmed back last year dramatically. So the whole thing is under pressure. There's no question about it. We feel for the organisers, but to live cheek by jowl every year, waiting for a grant to keep you going, it just goes to show how tough it is.
It is tough. It's very tough. And it's just depressing me.
Okay. Well, on that depressing note, let's get into something. Let's hope a little bit more positive as we talk to Joe Chadwick from Crescent Swan Publishing. He's based over in Essex, and he's headed up to publish his own book to start with, and is looking to add more authors as he goes. Tim Franks was his first, and we spoke to him a few weeks ago. From down the road in Wolverhampton, where, in fact, we're going tonight to watch a gig. Johnny Marr again in concert tonight. But anyway, that's a by the by. So nice to talk to Joe and, really get under the skin of why somebody dedicates their time to, because it's a tough industry, as we keep talking about on this programme, to set up a micro-publisher such as Crescent Swan. So let's talk to Joe Chadwick. Such a pleasure to speak to Joe Chadwick from Crescent Swan Publishing. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Real pleasure. And we gather it's your first podcast, so welcome to the world being a guest on one of these things.
Yeah, looking forward to it.
The first of many.
Brilliant. I was thinking about first questions, but as we're both, all three of us are publishers, the question that came to mind is, are you mad?
Yeah, it does. I can see why you'd ask that. It's certainly quite a big undertaking. Although I should imagine you are far more experienced in publishing than I am myself. I feel very much like I'm just figuring out how to do it as I go along. But having spoken to other people in similar sized publishing businesses, I suppose you could call them, that seems to be the consensus with a lot of people. It's one of those things, I think, that you do it because you genuinely enjoy it and you have a passion for it. I mean, I certainly didn't. How I got into becoming a publisher, as it were, wasn't I just decided that I wanted to start a publishing company. It was through publishing my own novel a few years ago originally, and then doing that through setting up a small publishing house. And then I sort of just had that publishing house existing, and in the following years, I thought, oh, I kind of enjoyed that, and I wonder if I could do it with someone else's work, and if someone else would want to work with me, which happened with the book I've recently published is by Tim Franks, who you had on your show a couple of weeks ago. But yes, no, back to your original question. I suppose, yes, I'm a little bit mad.
Yeah.
But I was going to say, were you talking about the sort of knowing what you're doing? And I hate to say it, but even after all this time, I still don't know what I'm doing.
No, slightly, I suppose that's comforting in a way, but worrying in other ways, I don't know.
It's partly because things change very quickly in publishing, I think, especially over the last 5 to 10 years, things have changed like almost beyond recognition. You think you've nailed it,
yeah.
And then everything changes.
And you've been going as long as we have, so 2020 roughly, for the both of us. And in that time, things have changed, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, part of my journey with it before I took on someone else's work was really figuring out like what sort of publishing business it's going to be. I mean, it's obviously very small because I run it in my own time. And, you know, there's only two books so far. And part of that process was looking at just sort of the landscape of publishing and the publishers that I, business models that I looked at and sort of how they were set up were ones that I suppose you would call more modern publishers in terms of they focus predominantly on selling ebooks. I mean, and, you know, financially, that a publisher of, I mean, I'll speak for myself here. I don't want to speak for all small publishers, but financially, that seems to be one of the only viable business models that I would be able to do this with. Because, I mean, initially when I did my own book, I did a couple of small print runs, and just when you add in distribution and everything, it just you can't make a profit unless you're obviously ordering the quantity which the big publishing houses will. But you know, that's I would have to. My bedroom was only so big so that I could.
You should see our kitchen.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I with my first book, I mean, I remember I was living at my parents at the time when I did it, and I literally just my bed lifted up, and I had my underneath my bed was just hundreds of books, and I was completely clueless then to the distribution side of everything. I mean, I was posting them out manually. I was delivering boxes to bookshops. And then, you know, that was another factor which I just didn't take into consideration at first was all the postage costs and everything. So after that first print run, I thought, okay, well, this isn't doable like this. So I need to really look at how this is doable and how I can, you know, put something of a naive business hat on and think, okay, well, if I want to keep doing this, how do I make it fund itself. And then that's when I really sort of delved into looking at obviously smaller and independent publishers out there, and there's obviously bigger independent publishers as well, but there was a couple who their business model was predominantly focusing on just selling ebooks with print on demand, which is the sort of business model I now adopted. I suppose you guys are nodding, so you probably found similar.
Yeah,
totally. Yeah,
I mean, most the majority of our books are print on demand. We do sometimes a small print run. It's particularly happened if a book has been long listed or shortlisted for a prize, because then bookshops will want to stock it. So, you know, doing big print runs on print on demand is certainly not viable.
No.
But once you know you're going to be able to get them into bookshops, then you know that you will make some money on that. But
Yeah.
Yeah. Our main focus is we want the ebooks to fund any sort of hard copies that we create.
Yeah. I think that is really the model. I mean, the third way which people are starting to do is to get the Kickstarter route. And so if you know you Kickstarter it and get enough people to want the book, that pays for the print run, and you're not tying down capital doing that. And that's something that we will look at, because it is such an enormous suck of money, and it takes forever if you even if you sell all those books for it to come back, and let alone it be profitable. So, you know, that's something that a debate you have with authors all the time. I mean, there isn't an author out there who doesn't want to see their book in their local bookshop.
Yeah, and I totally understand that. You know, I'd love to walk into my local Waterstones and see my name on the table. Who wouldn't?
Yeah. I think
the cold reality is it's just uneconomic at the moment.
Well, exactly. I mean, the on that note, though, with the bookshop thing, what is good about independent bookshops, especially local ones, is they are generally, in my experience, quite enthusiastic about stocking local authors. I mean, the independent bookshop, it's called Malden Books, which were from Malden, which it won quite a few awards actually, but they opened up in the end of 2019. So it was around the same time I'd done my thing. And again, sort of completely naively, I just got in touch with them and said, oh, would you be interested in stocking it? And yeah, I mean, they've stocked my book pretty much ever since I published it. They've stocked Tim's book, and he's not local at all. He's obviously Wolverhampton. I'm down in Essex. But just because I have this small local publishing business, they were happy to do it. But yeah, the chain's obviously a different game. Going back a few years, sort of naively just walked into a Waterstones and went, well, how do I get in here then? And they sort of told me the process. I did manage to get a few stocked in Waterstones, but that was mainly through, I don't know if trickery is the right word, but the Waterstones near me did an Instagram story where they said, oh, anyone, any books they want to see specifically stocked? So I just messaged all my friends and said, can you all reply to that story with The Briar Men, which was my novel one?
Yes.
They did. And then that seemed to be, other people started to see him doing it because they sort of started a thing. And then, yeah, next time I went in, there was about 4 or 5 copies on the shelf. So
I love that. Trickery
and deceit can work, but I wouldn't recommend it on a large scale.
Well, that's the nature of it, isn't it? That, you know, things are, there's no easy channel into a Waterstone. So it is doing things. Kind of guerrilla marketing in that way.
Oh yeah.
And taking, you know, using unorthodox tactics to beat the system a little bit.
We've managed to get some more stocked in Waterstones, partly, like I say, so if they're long listed or shortlisted for a prize, they suddenly sit up and say, oh, what's this? But there's the bookshop in Southwold is kind of strange because it's officially Waterstones, although it's called the Southwold Bookshop. And I've been in touch with the lady who manages it, and she will stock the books, but then it gets paid through Waterstones, which takes forever.
That's the other thing. Yeah, they're not quick to pay. So, so we go back to that sort of thing of, you know, are you mad to be an independent publisher? But, you know, so initially your impulse was to create your own publishing house to create The Briar Men and get it out there. So, in terms of writing, going into that side of things, when did you start it and what was the spark?
So I suppose, I think it probably took me about 2 years. So I published it 2020, so maybe 2017, 2018. And I'd always, I suppose looking back now, always writing was always, and just creating stories, and that was always something I did. And then when I was at university, I ended up just taking a creative writing class to fill out my timetable and really enjoyed it. And that's when I sort of thought, oh, like maybe it's something I can do with this. At the time, I was taking a lot of, they were like script writing classes, and I thought, oh, it'd be great to be a write films and that. But obviously, you can very quickly learn writing a film means it also needs to be made, which is incredibly unlikely and incredibly expensive if you want to try and do it yourself. And that's when I thought, well, you know, writing a book, you're writing or a novel, you know, what you're writing is essentially the finished product if you strip away the actual sort of production side of it. And like, you know, all writers tried a million things, and then the Briar Men, that's just something I started and finished. The story for that came to me when I was on a run, actually, out in sort of the local countryside, and a plane flew overhead. I just remember thinking, like, oh, if there were weird creatures that lived out in these sort of woods, what would they think a plane is? They'd probably think it was a dragon or something. And I thought, well, not nowadays, because there'd always be planes, but if you go back to around sort of World War II, the Blitz, that's when they'd first experienced that. And yeah, that was a sort of the initial seed. Yeah, and then spent a couple of years trying to finished it, and then thought, well, I'll try and get this published now. Sent it off to a bunch of agents, just sort of got the standard no thanks replies. And then this was during the first lockdown, so I thought, like probably a lot of people, well, I've got time on my hands. I've always wanted to, you know, try and run my own little business. So just decided, right, I'll just make myself a publishing company if I can't get one. Partly, I suppose, maybe just to seem like on face value, I didn't want to just do it under my own name, even though, you know, it's a self-published book. I didn't want to just have Joe Chadwick as publisher's novel. I thought I want to give it an imprint, a publishing house to do it through. Yeah, and then just taught myself as much as I could about how to do that and went from there, really.
And as you say, you keep learning. It sort of, we do too. There's no time you ever feel you're on top of it. I think partly, and I was going to say this when we were first talking about that, the fact is with publishing, so many moving parts within the publishing process, so many aspects that, you know, everything needs to go right, but the effort it takes to make sure that all those aspects come together at the right time, you know, it's monumental. I don't think people appreciate just, you know, all the different things that have to be right. So, for instance, the thing that catches us out quite innocently all the time is Amazon. You know, you put a book up and it'll find a reason for it not to be published on the day you expect because of X, Y, Z, things that the system throws in, for instance. But, you know, there's so many other aspects that, you know, the typesetting, the cover design, yeah. You know.
You have to be good at schedules.
Yeah. There is that aspect to it. I mean, I've never had that problem with. Again, I've done two books, but I didn't have that problem with Amazon myself. One problem I did have with Amazon was I had a promotion. I'd entered my book into some promo deal where they were going to send it out to their mailing list, and I'd had to make it 99p on a certain day.
Right. Yeah.
And I've never had an issue with Amazon where it didn't do it within a few hours. And for some reason, on this specific day, it took like the max. It says it can take up to 72 hours. And I've spent, you know, like you have to get these promotions, you have to pay for them. And I'd already bought the promotion and it was a sort of no refunds thing. And Amazon just didn't do it. So I just, the one occasion where I changed the price and it didn't work. So yeah, there is little things like that you do learn. Well, I mean, I've learned through mistakes to just try and stay as on top of as possible, which was quite interesting doing Days of Long Shadows, Tim's book. Obviously, I felt with this one, I've got someone else's work in my hands here, and I can't, you know, I can't afford to make those mistakes when it's not just my work. And I suppose it's sort of the cliche thing of you do learn from your mistakes. And another thing doing my own book taught me was, you know, I made all these mistakes and right, if I'm going to do someone else's, this is what I need to make sure I don't do this time.
Yes.
So yeah, all the sort of expensive mistakes I made with my own novel, I learned quickly from and didn't. And I'm still trying not to make them with someone else's novel.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean. I mean, I think our very first publication was Robert Dawes, and a mistake I made was I decreased the text size because it was quite big, and I thought, oh, that's too big, that's going to cost too much. Decreased the text size, but then somebody complained and said, I can't read it. And do you remember that?
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, what we're conscious of is that in our genres of crime and mysteries and whatever, it's a mature readership. And so you can never be too generous in your font size. But from a paperback point of view, you know, a couple of points on your font size can be an extra 100 quid on the cost of printing the books.
Difference, but then I went back and increased the text size. But then, of course, we had to change the cover. and change all the metadata as well.
The spine starts to change. Everything changes. That's it. That's the thing. You learn that one little edit will set off a chain reaction of all these files you have set up. The covers, which has been made specifically for the spine size is this, and it's got to be within a few millimeters and all that. I had a font issue with the first print run of my book. I mean, these were advanced reader copies, so luckily they were. I said to everyone who I was sending them out to, right, there'll be probably some typos in that. These aren't the finished ones. But the font I'd used was, and I didn't know this was a thing, it was like the wrong type. When it printed, certain characters just didn't print because it was like the wrong type of font. When you converted it over to, it wasn't like a true font. I can't even remember off the top of my head, but I had to speak to the guy at the printer who walked me through it. And I said, okay, now I've got to change the font on the whole document, which, messed up the whole typeset. You know, it wasn't just a case of highlighting it and changing the font. It was a 3-day job. And it's just, that's what you learn. You learn these little things along the way. You go, okay, right, everything has to be planned meticulously, and each step has to be, I have to sort of give myself enough time that if there is a mistake, I can rectify it. I mean, that's what I've learned from the last couple of years.
Yeah, I think that's a very valuable thing, actually, making sure you've got enough time. So some of our authors are very impatient. And when I say to them, we can publish it in September, and they say, September, that's ages away. I've written it, surely it's not going to take 6 months for you to turn it into a book, but they don't understand that we need time for, it's like contingency time for, things do happen. And if you say we're publishing on that day, you have to publish on that day. You can't really let
it. And we did try to release books quickly, and
it was too stressful.
it just one mistake and the whole thing just falls apart if you haven't got the contingency.
Yeah, I mean, that was a good thing about working with Tim, actually, was that, when we did the contract and everything, I said, look, I'm going to give myself a year to do this because, and I was like, we probably could get out before the year, but I want to give a year so we have that space to make sure it's ready. Thankfully I did, because there were little things along the way when I was typesetting it and doing all this that these sort of little issues cropped up, and I had to spend a day or so fixing this and that, and obviously doing it all in my own time. It wasn't, I was doing it on the weekends and when I was getting home from work and that, so it's not like I had a year full time dedicated to it. It was a year in between, everything else. So I think a big thing is just not rushing and giving yourself that time, really. And from the author's point of view, I understand, for them, it's like you've finished your book and that's taken you all this time. And obviously what you want is to see it out there. And if you're lucky enough to work with a publisher, I can understand why there's that urge to see it. But having, experienced the other side of it, it's definitely better to just give yourself that breathing space, I would say.
Totally. And what's the mind shift? I mean, you were saying that it's a different thing taking responsibility for someone else's work and having that responsibility on you. What other mind set shifts have you made in terms of having that relationship with an author and managing their expectations and their anticipation?
That was actually a big thing for me to... When I decided I wanted to, try and take on someone else's work, I thought, okay, I'm not just doing this for the sake of it. One, it needs to be something I actually want to publish. Two, I need to manage the expectations. And I need to let them know, look, I am one guy who's just starting out. I'm trying to sort of grow this business book by book. You're probably not going to make loads of money. So I thought, I've got to be as transparent and upfront about me, myself, the business model, everything. That's how I went into it, really. I put out an advert for submissions, and I actually didn't really expect to get much back, but I got far more than I anticipated. but that's when I very much was like, okay, I'm not going to, it has to be something I like and I want to publish, because I'm not a, obviously independent publishers aren't big commercial publishers. No. This isn't for the, oh, well, this made me loads of money. This is, you know, this is a passion project, and I've connected with this work. And if the author and myself get on and we sort of share the same vision for it, we can work together and I can help bring it to the marketplace. And that was the case with Tim. I read his submission, liked it. We spoke a few times. I told him everything about, and you know, that at that point I'd only published my own book. So I said, look, I've only published my own work so far, but I would like to try and publish someone else's. And then the manager expectations part just came with, you know, being open, like, look, this is a predominantly, I'm going to focus on selling ebooks. You're not going to see it in bookshops. That's not the business model. But what you are going to get, which I imagine you won't get so much with big publishers, is you're going to be very involved in the process. Like the cover, obviously I organized all that, and I did the typeset myself and all that, but at each step of the way I was consulting him, like, right, here are our cover options, which ones do you like? But you know, this is the sort of, this is how it's going to be typeset, all this stuff. I tried to let him have a say in, and same with the editing, like everything, unless it was a grammatical or typo thing, every fit change I made would be, you know, I consulted him first, and I said, look, I think this should happen, do you agree? A lot of the time he said yes, sometimes he said no, and if he said no, it was his work. I wasn't going to change it just because I didn't like part of it. Not I didn't like part of it, but, you know, thought that this should be like that. So I think, you know, I've not worked with a big publisher, but I would say that I offered a far more involved process than you likely find with a big publisher.
Yes, you do. Absolutely. I mean, we have a very similar ethos. You know, I spend a lot of time talking to authors. I always send them the typeset, the design for the text. So, is there anything you want me to change about it? And they sometimes say, yeah, you know, I want the page number to be on the edge, not in the middle, or whatever it is. And same with editing, they always get the chance to go through their edits, and they can, I say, accept and reject, you know, just put your case forward, but I don't mind, you know, it's your book.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, you definitely don't get that with a big publisher, because they haven't got time, and they haven't got the, it's just sort of a very different process. You know, with us and with you, by the sounds of it, it's more of a nurturing thing, isn't it? You want the writer to become a better writer as a result of going through process of publishing their book, so that the next time they learn something from it and then develop themselves as well as you as a publisher.
Oh, absolutely. It's on both sides, I think. You know, I learned so much doing this Tim's book. And yeah, I think on the point of even things like you mentioned, like page numbers, and you don't realize until you do it with, I suppose, well, I didn't realize until I did it with my own work. One of the freeing aspects about how I did it myself with my novel was I had say over everything. So, and I can picture now, if it had gone with a bigger publisher, then there's certain things that I would have thought, well, I don't like that cover, or I would have liked like the chapters to be styled like that. So having say over everything, especially if you've written it yourself, does feel more like you have complete authorship, not only over the text and the story, but the project as a whole. And I tried to involve, you know, Tim in Days of Long Shadows as much as I could, so he could have that as well. And I think that's a great thing that independent publishers can offer, really, is that more sort of personal, close working relationship.
Totally. But I mean, it is time consuming. And, you know, it gets to a point, there are always moments in our lives where we think, do you know what? We don't have to do it this way. I mean, we don't, you know, it would be easier if we could do the benevolent dictator thing.
Yeah, this is your cover. It would be, of course it would be easier. Absolutely.
Yeah, because, you know, the bigger you get, because we've got, you know, you've got Tim, but we've got 23 authors who have a similar relationship to us. And
we do other work as well.
It's really difficult. And, you know, I'm sure it's the same, you know, in reverse, there'll be times when our authors are going, do you know what, if only I'd just done it myself, I wouldn't have this debate, and I'd have it the way I want. And it is finding that. But, you know, that's one of the joys of it. And in a sense that collaboration is never easy. You think of all the great collaboration, it's say music, for instance, how many groups who have collaborated for years don't point to the fact that they've broken up nearly a dozen times, yeah. You know, or came very close. I mean, even a group like U2, who always seem very unified on the front of it, have, you know, revealed gradually that actually there have been monumental bust-ups and near breakups.
Well,
all the way through their history.
The people don't know about our monumental breakups throughout the history of Hoback.
True. which ones are you referring to?
I've forgotten already.
Yeah, you scar over, the scar tissue is there. But it is that thing, you know, and actually, in a way, collaboration should have a bit of friction to it. Otherwise, is it really art?
Sometimes they're right. The author is right. And I will say to them, do you know what? I actually agree with you that with your cover would look better. And I hadn't thought of that.
I certainly had a few moments like that myself with Tim's book. It was written, I think you might have discussed this in your interview with him.
Yeah.
He's written it in the sort of dialect of the area. And when I'm going through it in a copy editing mode, I'm like, oh, that's not quite right. And then he would be like, no, that's meant to be like that. And then I started reading it in that voice. I thought, okay, yeah, no, that is right. And then, you know, there's little things like that where, because I did get that little pushback, it actually did serve the story. And you know, but it works both ways. There was points where I said, okay, actually this should be like this. And he agreed. But yeah, you got to give, there needs to be pushback from both sides, which again, you know, not speaking from experience, but I would imagine in larger publishing houses, that's not the case.
But I think where bigger publishing houses, you know, I can, the only equivalence I can do is with the BBC when I was working there. But you've worked in big publishing houses,
yeah.
The nature of it is the friction tends to be within that publishing house rather than between authors, because they just discount having a collaboration with the author. That's, you know.
Well, I'll give you.
You know, your book is not yours anymore, so don't you worry about it, love. We'll get on with it. Now we as the big adults here, we're going to. And then they, you know, all those different parts of a big publisher will argue over a cover, for instance.
Yeah,
you've talked about it frequently, that the sales team will get involved.
Good example. So the cover is a good example, but also when to publish. So the author has no say in when to publish. They deliver it, and then the marketing and the sales and the production and the editorial get together and say, we can schedule this for next spring or whatever. And then with the cover as well, you'll have a meeting where the sales and the marketing, everybody's in the meeting. We used to call them covers meetings. Don't know why. And the designer would stand at the front, he'd put the cover up, and he would get a barrage of all sorts of opinions. And then it would go to the author as, this is your cover, that it's past the meeting. And we had one author, it was a Oxford History of 20th Century Art, I think it was. And the cover was the inside of a gallery, and there was a painting on the wall, and it had a nude, right? You'd think that would be fine, wouldn't you, for an art book? Yeah. The author said, over my dead body, are you publishing that with a nude body on the front? And we said, yeah, we are.
Did they? Yeah. Did you?
Yeah. Oh. He couldn't object just because it was a naked person on a book about art.
No, it's fascinating. So, I mean, I guess what we're concluding is that, you know, no matter how positive the initial talks around a relationship, there are always going to be areas of friction. And sometimes they, you know, they get out of control. Sometimes they, you know, they're more manageable. But in terms of, you know, where you see you're going to take things now, so you've got your first author on board, other than yourself. Have you ambitions to expand that? Or is the cold reality that because it's so time consuming and resource consuming that it's going to be a slow process?
It's definitely going to be a slow process, unless, you know, but either one of the books becomes a bestseller overnight. I mean, my book has done a lot better than I ever thought it would, and it's sort of still ticking along quite consistently, which having looked into, you know, sales figures for authors, you know, it's actually quite done quite well, really. But that's taken, you know, now what we like now nearly 4 years, and that's just through sort of consistency and learning how to market digitally and who to market to and all that. And that's what I'm doing with Tim's book as well. You know, I said to him, like, this is going to be a slow process. We're just going to figure out who to market to, how best to market it each month, sort of look at what ads we're putting out there and slowly build up reviews. You know, that's working with my book at the moment. In terms of bringing in other authors on board, I mean, I do plan to keep Crescent Swan going, and you know, inevitably that means bringing on other book, well, hopefully bringing on other authors in the future, but also doing my own writing. I'd like to write more myself. One big lesson I did learn this past year, whilst publishing someone else's work, was you can really only focus on one thing. so because I then put all my stuff on the back burner, and again, it's just sort of you're just a bit naive to the reality of it. I mean, I actually made where around the time I made offered to publish Tim's work, I did make an offer to, there was one other manuscript I'd read amongst the submissions, which I really liked. I did make an offer to that author, but it was sort of no hard feelings. Once I explained my sort of business model, it wasn't for her, no hard feelings. And in hindsight, I'm quite glad that she did reject that, because again, it was just me not being fully aware, like, the workload and having to sort of take on two books over the last year would have been too much. And I've learned that with, you know, trying to sort of write more stuff on my own, that if I want to release another book, that needs to be my next project. So the business is very much project to project basis. And
yes,
what I'm thinking my next project is going to be is sort of finish some of the stuff I've started, put that out there. I mean, it's going to add to the body of work, which will be published by Crescent Swan. So it's still going to, you know, be part of the business. It's just obviously it's one of my own books. And yeah, then I think just once that project's done, see what I want to do next, sort of thing. The good thing as well is, I don't know sort of what industry standard is, but especially with being a smaller publishing house, I was able to say to Tim, okay, look, it's not going to be like I own the rights to your book for life. There's a set period, and after that amount of years, we'll reassess. Like, are you happy? Am I happy? You know, and there's obviously the option for the author to have their rights back. I don't know how it works with the length that the bigger publishing houses have the rights to books for, but certainly the way I plan to do it with mine is not have them sort of ridiculously long, just do it in a few year periods. So both parties can say, like, look, if this isn't working out in a few years' time, then there's always the option to
a mutual break clause. Yeah.
It's a sort of no hard feelings thing. It's like, you know, it was a good experience. And obviously, you know, it's not what you'd hope it wouldn't come to that, but it's, I suppose it's actually good for both parties when you have a small business and an author to know that you're not sort of trapped in this lifelong contract where you've just given all the rights to your book away. And also another thing is just that the rights that I'm after aren't, they're just not like every all the rights, because another thing you learn when you start publishing is just how many different types of rights there are, and
serial rights on radio and things like
yeah, yeah. I mean, I remember when I decided that I was going to do it, I bought a couple books on writing contracts and all the rights, and the list of rights was exhaustive, and you just think, okay, well, I don't need any of these. I'm not going to exploit them, or I'm not going to try to use them. I don't need them. Speaking to sort of the Society of Authors and that about contracts, they say one of the things they say is, you know, you've got to be careful what rights people are after, or like publishers are after, and will they actually use those rights. So that's another thing is just, yeah, the way I see it is just take the rights that, or offer to for the rights that you want to work with. In this case, it's ebooks and print on demand and paperbacks and that.
I mean, I think one piece of advice we would always give is get the contracts straightened out before you do anything.
Oh, absolutely.
Actually paid a lawyer, didn't we, to do ours. So at the cost of a conservatory, I'll say. But we've used that model for more or less for everybody with some tweaks here and there, and it's worked out well. But I'm actually glad we did spend the cost of a conservatory on
I think that's quite a small conservatory, but, you know, we're going to give the impression that it's mega, you know.
I don't know. Okay, well, shed then.
Certainly, well, it was more than that. I don't know how I would describe it, but a decent family holiday for four in the school holidays.
Surprise!
Yeah, you know, it was an expensive. I mean, you know, we probably balk at it now, but at the time, it felt like the right thing to do.
Yeah, and I don't regret it at all. No. He was a specialist in publishing. Okay. And I, you know, we wanted something that would last us throughout however long Hoback lasts for.
I mean, I suppose that is interesting. I mean, obviously, as you alluded to earlier, you've got 23 authors, and that's, you know, I can't even imagine having to deal with that at the stage I'm at. But on the point of contract, it was something that, yeah, we made sure we were both happy with, and we worked out, and we did consult the Society of Authors, who were very good about that, and gave great advice. And made sure that everything was good and proper sort of before we went forward with anything.
Sure.
Yeah, they are very good. Some of our authors have sent our contract to Society of Authors, and actually some of their feedback, I've thought, do you know what? That's interesting. That's slightly different to what the lawyer put in, but actually I prefer what the Society of Authors are suggesting. And
it goes back to the point at the beginning of the conversation about how publishing industry is changing constantly. I mean, especially now with all the AI stuff that
yes
being talked about everywhere, that's something that's obviously needs to be considered going into contracts, because that's sort of just AI, you know. I wouldn't assume that bigger publishing houses would use AI for in covers and that, but if you just look at sort of Amazon now, the amount of AI generated books that are out there, and they're having to clamp down on that. And, you know, you don't want, if, for example, an author went with a very small publisher who decided that, oh, you know, I'm going to use AI to generate the cover because it's going to save me X amount of money, you know, you don't know where that's going to land your book in a month's or 2 months' time when Amazon changed their policy on it. So it's these sort of little things in contracts are always changing and being added in that.
If you had the opportunity to change an aspect of publishing in the favour of a company like yours or indeed ours, what would it be?
I think the what I would change is, and it is from my limited experience, is just how difficult and complex distribution seems to be. It's one of them things that still is, I sort of sit down and like to get my head around it, how it works, but to get widely distributed into bookshops and that is just not easy or simple. I mean, it's not cheap either, but the another sort of reason I ended up going for the print on demand model and ebook model is because it quite literally is the only way I can operate it. You know, like we mentioned, authors would love to see their books in a bookshop, and that's, you know, I can relate to that. That's what I want to see with my book. But there came a point where I thought, well, it's so expensive because to distribute your book, because it's not just the bookshop that's taking their cut, it's the distributor, and then it's also the supply. Like there's a whole chain, and it's not just it's not a small chain. And you have to find a distributor, and then you look at the cost, you look at how much money you can make at the end of it, and you're sort of lucky if it's not a loss, really. And I think the way that the big publishers can get around that is they can print so cheap because they're printing massive print runs, whereas obviously, you know, prices of everything have gone up in the last few years, and including printing. Even since I started, the cost of printing's like shot right up.
Yeah, it has.
And that just makes it so inaccessible for smaller publishers to enter that to that space, which is why, you know, it's good that there is an option to, you know, Amazon now exists that you can sort of do it through there, but it would also be great if there was more access and there was a way into that, because unless you can afford to do a massive print run, then you're not really going to get into those chains, and it's a whole other sort of marketplace that you're missing out on.
Yeah, totally. No, I agree.
Yeah. Totally. Well, we've got to that point, Joe.
There we go.
Rebecca laughs nervously. We all take a deep breath, and
I never know how the person's going to react to my question.
And we await Rebecca's random question.
Okay, so my random questions usually come from something that's happened in the week or a thought I've had. And I had a thought this week. I was listening to Radio 4 in the car, and it was, what's it called, that politics thing? What's it called?
Any questions?
Any questions, right? And every time somebody, he's probably thinking, where's this going? Anytime somebody came up with an insightful thought or point, everybody starts to clap. And I was sat there driving, I thought, clapping is such a weird thing to do and quite old-fashioned. So my question to you is there something that humans do that you think is really weird?
Something that humans do that, well... I just thought I could get really deep and just comment on society here, but I really won't go down that route. I suppose clapping is quite weird. Something that's really weird that humans do. I suppose just to bring it back to your first question about being mad is you know, doing anything that like this that sort of just takes a lot of time and preparation. I've been training for the Brighton Marathon recently, and I've now decided that running is pretty mad, and just sort of doing ridiculous amounts of exercise, that you just sort of finish. You're like, I don't know why I've done that. I remember listening to a podcast where they said it was about a guy who'd gone to stay with a tribe of hunter gatherers, and they said. He asked them what they do for exercise, and they didn't have a direct translation for the word exercise. And when it was explained to them, they laughed and said, why would you do that if you don't need to? Why would you run if you don't need to? Obviously they were obviously incredibly fit tribe of hunter gatherers, but they did it because they needed to. So to them, I suppose it was absurd that
you do it for leisure.
Yeah.
It is absurd, actually, when you think about it. Running to go back to where you started.
Yeah.
The house.
I think training for a marathon has led me to think quite absurd.
I think shaking hands is kind of
weird. That is weird, isn't it?
And I think the fact that people use, traditionally it's right hand to right hand, isn't it? And isn't that something to do with you shake hands, which means that you can't draw your sword because normally it would be on your left hip.
So I can draw my sword.
Right. But, you know, and all that sort of tradition. And sometimes, you know, at what point does a handshake, you know, what point in the relationship with somebody do you go in for the air hug
or the
air kisses, thing? And at what point does that become actually a kiss on the cheek as opposed to, I can't figure out when the rules are played, especially nowadays where
easy thing about COVID. No one could do any of them greetings. Everyone knew where they stood.
And it's kind of weird because, you know, you approach somebody and you just don't know if they're not giving you the signal that they want to have a handshake or whatever, or high five or whatever, the huggy thing. I mean, it's kind of awkward. Or if you go in for the huggy thing and you both then slightly take a half step back because those things make me crease up with, you know, anxiety.
Yeah, me too. In fact, we met one of our authors last week and he shook your hand.
Yeah.
And then I thought, do I shake my hand?
No, he went in for the hug.
The hug. fine, because I knew that's what was going to happen. But I know what you mean. Is that second of, I've never met this guy before. Is he going to want a hug?
Yeah. And I think it's more a reflection of my own anxiety and internal sort of, you know, imposter syndrome, whatever it might be at any given situation. I know that when I'm in command of a, you know, say I was the boss, as I was, then I could set the rules in a sense. So, you know, this relationship is going to, and we're going to finish this conversation with a handshake, and it's going to be my decision because I'm the boss.
That's weird, wanting to share the sweat on your hand with another person.
Anyway, what's yours?
Like,
oh, clapping.
Clapping, yes, sorry.
Yeah, you're only sharing the sweat in your hands with yourself when you're clapping, so.
Yeah.
True, yeah.
And also, I mean, so then you get to this thing where, you know, it's just something that my son and I were discussing. We were driving back from Cardiff, where he's been at university, so I picked him up for the Easter holidays. And every service station we went to, the hand dryers would only trigger at a point where it would dry your wrist, but not your fingers. So as soon as you pulled back to get into the jet stream, the thing would shut down again. And so every time, and this happened three times on our journey, we came out with wet fingers, but very dry wrists. I mean, so then you're going into a handshake situation. What do you do then when you've got wet hands? I mean, you're still
shaking hands with it.
Well, no, I wouldn't necessarily be doing that, but this is the thing about hand dryers. Anyway, look, we've gone off into, as ever, with Rebecca's random question.
Yeah, but I like your answer, though, because running is really weird.
Yeah.
I tried it, and I didn't really enjoy it. I found it quite boring.
It gets boring when you have to, when you're doing it for 3 hours at a time.
Yeah. Well, I like taking that on, and I feel the same because I did some extreme cycling in my past, a long time ago. And it's a similar thing when you get to the... that feeling.
You can read a book. You can listen, I suppose, to a book.
Although it can be easier than trying to write a book, though, which is the weird thing.
That's true.
True.
Yeah, that's a good point.
That's a whole other conversation.
Yeah, it is. Well, we'll draw this one to a close. So in terms, Joe, of finding you online and Crescent Swan, where should people look?
Well, there's the website, which is just crescentswan.com. Social media, the only one that I'm really... active on is Instagram. I'm not that active on that either, but like I say, it's very
not
much
unless it's water stains.
Well, yeah, unless they're but it's like it's very much a slow burn business model. So I post when I need to is my philosophy. Yeah. But yeah, crescentswan.com or follow it's crescent_swan on Instagram and
fantastic
all the stuff there.
Well, Joe, it's been a pleasure to meet you, and we wish you every success with. Albeit, you know, one project
and
at a
time. And
your next
writing, yeah. So
yeah, exactly.
For that run, get onto the keyboard.
And you know, as ever, with the indie publishing scene, the more we can all help each other, the better. Because, you know, let's be honest, the rest of the industry ain't going to help us. So we've got to help each other.
Thanks for having me.
All power to Joe and to all the micro publishers of the world.
Absolutely.
We reach out. Yes,
yeah.
Absolutely. And we'll be talking to another one next week.
Yes. Yeah, quite different again, but interesting conversation.
Yeah, Stuart DeBar from
SRL Publishing.
SRL Publishing. And SRL Publishing are members of the Indie Press Network, and they are the pioneers of sustainable publishing in terms of, you know, looking at every aspect of what they do and offsetting every book and every tree that, therefore, is used to produce the books. They offset and have built up a sort of credit in the bank, if you like, with the number of trees that they've had planted using their profits to do so.
It's an interesting story, isn't it, how that happened for
It was not quite by accident, but yeah, largely, you know, coincidentally.
Yeah, so it wasn't the main focus of starting a company, but it happened and it's a good thing.
Yeah, absolutely. So we'll talk to Stuart, and trust me, that interview will reveal many, many things.
Yes.
About you know, the difficulties of running a small publisher and
the highs and the lows, and the in betweeners
of a, you know, in this pandemic world. No, I mean post pandemic world. Yeah, sounding rather like the start of the program. So we'll look forward to that. Now we've been really busy. We're always busy.
Oh, it's been bonkers yet again.
Yeah, it has been, and let's think, you know, bonkers bits of Hoback work.
Just because we seem to have had a lot of things publishing in March and April, and going into May and June. So there's been a lot of sort of getting the text ready, getting the covers ready.
Yeah.
So quite a lot of work on the Hoback front. So we have a book publishing. We don't have a book publishing this week.
Gosh.
But we do next week.
Oh, yeah.
We do. Malcolm Hollin-Drake's Edge of the Land.
Yes.
His next book is coming out.
The third in the Merseyside crime series. And I've just started doing some narration on it, getting back my Scouse accent.
Well, it's interesting, is it? Because you've been narrating two books at the same time.
Well, so, yes, I have.
There are relationships between the accents, which you've illustrated to me. So,
well, I'm doing one which is set in the West Midlands, Stratford-upon-Avon, to be exact. And, you know, it's a new accent for me. I mean, okay, I live in the West Midlands now. But, you know,
I
you don't
say that, but yeah,
but it's not. But this is, you know, the area we live in doesn't really have the sort of accents that someone like Stratford does.
Well, a Stafford accent's a really interesting blend because it's kind of like a soft Stoke, I think.
Yes.
A very soft Stoke, but there are little bits of the West Midlands.
It's all sorts of things. But anyway, that's not the accent I need to do. The accent is Stratford, some Birmingham and Worcester and all that sort of area. And I'm not sure I've nailed it yet.
No,
to be perfectly honest. But this is the same feeling I had when I started doing the Merseyside ones. And again, I mean, Merseyside, there are so many different types of accent from Merseyside.
There are. It's a fascinating place.
It's incredible, incredible range of different sounds of voices. And I think, you know, I'm gradually finding that the same in the West Midlands. You know, we can't all sound like, you know, Arthur from the Peaky Blinders. that kind of approach. It can't, you know, it doesn't fit all. So that's really where I'm focusing at the moment, amongst many other little bits and bobs. But
yeah, so you've left Malta and gone to the West Midlands.
I have, yes. And, you know, the challenge continues. So in terms of, you know, the weekend, we're going to a gig tonight, which we're really excited to see Johnny Marr live in concert again. You know, it never lets you down.
No, and it's very strange because, like buses, I had two gigs come together. So I actually went to a gig last night in Wolverhampton. I went to see the Bare Naked Ladies, which if you'd told me I'm going out to see the Bare Naked Ladies tonight, I might have got a bit...
The funny thing is with going to gigs is that you had to buy the tickets so many months ahead that you almost forget they're coming around. Then suddenly you get the reminder and go... Oh, don't forget, in 48 hours, you're going to see such and such.
But you buy them months ahead because you panic, thinking they're going to sell out.
Well, often
they
do. Well, sometimes they do, sometimes they don't.
Yeah, this one, they didn't, because I've been having emails saying the tickets are still available. So, but, sometimes so the Johnny Marr ones are more likely to sell out. But I know what you mean. And we did actually fall foul of forgetting we were due to go to something, didn't we? I can't remember what it was.
Yes, it was, what's his name, James Acaster, is it? A comedian who's becoming really quite big, and he was playing the Buxton Opera House. And I bought tickets for it months ago, and I completely forgot, you know, months later that he was playing and we were due to be there.
Yeah, so it was like lunchtime and you said, I thought it was London.
No, don't think so. No.
Oh, maybe I'm thinking of something else.
Oh, gosh, right. Well, that's very profligate. We don't tend to go out that much.
No, not
so this
often.
Is kind of a, you know, having a cluster of things happening at once is a rarity. But, yeah, so, you know, lots of the kids are back at school this week, which is, I'm not sure if it's a good thing or a bad thing. I mean, sure, you know, summer term's always a weird one. One's got big, big exams.
Well, he said last night, he said, this is my last flurry of excitement before I do my A-levels.
Yeah, yeah, that does tend to weigh down somewhat.
Yeah, it's going to be hard. He's going to have a tough few months. Mm. So that's Josh. And we've still got Luke, the oldest, for two more weeks, I think.
Right, before he gets back to university.
Before he returns to Leeds. So, yes, it'll be the usual to-ing and fro-ing, cooking, cleaning after them.
Mm.
Finding rugby socks, that sort of thing.
Anyone see my tie? Oh, boy. Yeah, yeah, exactly. All those sort of things. Yeah. It's going to be back to that rhythm, which is fine. Okay, well, look, thank you for joining us here on the show, the Hobcast Book Show. Well, we do it for you, and we're so grateful
for your patronage. Thank you for joining us and listening to us every week. And if you're new to the show, please don't forget to subscribe to us. And we do this every Monday. We've got new shows. We've got some great guests lined up in the months to come.
We do. And we might try and do some more of those panel discussions.
Yes.
Actually, we're due to do another one.
Yeah, and we're thinking of doing something a little different in the summer, which, you know, we're still sort of mulling over how we could do it. But let's put it this way. It won't be necessarily a podcast.
It'll a work in progress.
It'll be something on a different platform.
Oh, say no more.
Yeah. But we're just sort of we're just playing with the idea at the moment, and that's really the currency of a company like us and the two of us. I mean, it's just having fresh ideas and trying new things, and keeping on top of it.
Yes, it's you rushing around with your ideas and me following behind, going wait.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's like that.
Yeah, exactly. Because I get crazily excited about ideas. Okay, so thank you for joining us. And don't forget to look at our website too, www.hobeck.net, for details of our books, our authors, and everything else. And we're going to do something new with the website very, very soon. So keep your eyes peeled for that. We'll let you know in a future show. But for myself, Adrian Hobart.
And myself, Rebecca Collins.
We wish you a wonderful and
creative
week. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Hobcast from Hobeck Books with Adrian Hobart and Rebecca Collins. You can find the show notes at our website, www.hobeck.net. You can also use the exclusive Hobcast discount code for any of the products at our Hobeck online store. Just enter the code HOBCAST20 for 20% discount. Don't forget to subscribe to The Hobcast and feel free to contact us with any feedback. Until next time, remember our motto, Trad Values, Indie Spirit.